One of the things that I'm trying to understand is today, in 2015, why does Corey Weeds, why does Corey Weeds like jazz? why don't you just do rock or something like that, or pop, or why is it jazz? Like, and you're not just a guy who plays jazz because you make some money on the side. You're a fanatic about it.
Yeah,
by all accounts.
Yeah, I definitely have a passion for it. That's for sure. I mean, you know, I sort of came to it fairly late. You know, I mean, I think for me, there's, you know, I don't just do one thing, so it's always very intertwined. I mean, why jazz? I mean, I grew up with listening to it in my house, but I grew up listening to rock, and I grew up doing everything most kids end up doing. Although my dad was a jazz fan, so there was more jazz in my house than probably for the average kid. And it just sort of took hold of me. I'm trying to think of a nice way to say this about myself. I mean, it was pretty clear I wasn't going to be a lawyer or a doctor.
Well, you can say whatever you want about yourself.
You know, I mean, it was pretty clear. I had some confidence when I was younger. I had an entrepreneurial spirit, which I think was very evident early on. And I think I had some talent in music. You know, you're a product, I think, of your environment, and the music that was playing around my house wasn't rock and pop, it was jazz music. So it's natural that I would sort of take that course. Then I, you know, through my teenage years, I wanted to do everything that my parents didn't want me to do, so I listened to rock and all of that kind of stuff. But this music just took hold of me more so than any other music. You know, and then I came to a sort of a crossroads when I, like most kids do, you know, I graduated and I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, I was pretty clear that I didn't really want to go to school. I was done with, like, that was the best part about graduating done.
Yeah.
So music was a viable option for me. I could go and get my degree. I think my parents really hoped that I become a teacher, because in their world and they're right. I mean, a teaching gig is a very solid, well-paid, respectable gig, and that was sort of the way I was kind of pushed. But it became fairly clear to me that that's not what I wanted to do. I went to school for 2 or 3 years part-time. I was living in Vancouver. I went to Cap College and had a great experience there, but I was working and starting to gig, and I'm starting to do some stuff, and had a girlfriend, and, you know, I was kind of living the life. I had a car, and, you know, I was a young guy just doing it, you know. And then I got an opportunity. I got a scholarship to go to University of North Texas, which I took. I was one of the first people to go down there after Brad Turner. And then I kind of started a wave of people that continued on after me. But it became clear when I was at North Texas, I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to get my degree. I'm going to come home. I'm going to get my bachelor's. And then I'm going to go back and get my master's and live happily ever after. And I came home. I ended up starting to do some radio work in North Texas. They had a very large radio station that was jazz at the university. So just kind of another thing that I kind of had in my toolbox. And I came home and enrolled back at Cap and realized very quickly that I'm never going to be a teacher. It's not what I want to do. It's not my passion. It's not what I like. It's just not really for me. It's not what I want to do. So I quit. And I joined a pop band, and sort of a pop kind of jammy band, and toured all over Canada and got to see Canada.
This would have been 90s?
In 90, no, this would have been around 95, 96.
Okay.
And we went to Europe, toured Italy, you know, fell in love with a woman in Italy and went back like 3 or 4 times and just started like really living my life and playing music. You know, and a lot of stuff happened, and then, you know, one thing led to another, and an opportunity to buy a jazz club came up, and I did it, and I expected it to be in business for a year, and it was in business for, you know, the better part of 14, and, you know, here I am all these years later, back in the business, you know, in a different way.
Yeah.
But I was just, you know, my goal was to never move to New York and practice 12 hours a day and try to turn the musical world on its ear. My goal was to be involved in this music in any way that was natural. I mean, I didn't really set out to do any of this stuff. I mean, you know, it just, everything happened for me very organically. And it's sort of odd to sit back after, you know, here I'm 42 years old and say, like, I've made my living in jazz. Like, there's nothing about my living that's, oh, I have this day gig and I do jazz at night. Like, my whole life has been jazz. And it's a very cool feeling. It's a very odd feeling sometimes. Like, I kind of wonder, why me? Like, why have I been able to deal with this? Like, how could I, you know, I'm raising two kids and I have a mortgage and we have two cars and I'm working my butt off, but I'm doing it, you know? And it's, I think I still have a very young mentality in that I don't see myself as necessarily, like, I still see myself as a young kid, like, still striving for success. But I am successful. So, like, sit back and just relish it and keep doing it. Like, yeah, I've worked really hard. But I think that's also part of what keeps me moving forward, is that mentality of, no, you're not done yet. You're not a success. Keep going. Like, you're not successful yet. Like, enough. And I don't think I have anything in my mind that would make me successful. Maybe Kim told me, oh, now I'm making $100,000 a year. Would that be... would I rest on my laurels? Probably not. It's not the kind of guy I am. I'm really driven by what can I do, what more can I do for the music? I'm not doing enough. And because I think if you don't do it, it will die. Nobody, I've always said this and it's a joke, but I mean it. Like, nobody's stupid enough to do what I do, because it's a lot of work for not necessarily the type of reward that you're looking for.
Right.
And I feel like if I don't do it, nobody's going to do it. And that's not to say there are not other people doing it. There are dozens of other people who are working just as hard as me for this music. But, I mean, I have 15 years under my belt, and I continue to do what I can to push the music forward, and with no real goal of what I'm trying to accomplish other than pushing the music forward and not letting it die, you know. So that's sort of what drives me, you know, and... that's why I like the music. There is opportunity in this music. There's so much negativity around the music business in general. But I've been down here the last four nights in a row, and I've seen 70, 80, 100, 40, 30 people in the audience that are loving it, buying CDs, you know, the jazz festival. I just presented Joey DeFrancesco, you know, through my work with Coastal, and it was packed and people loving it. So, like, it's not all negative.
Yeah.
It's just different. It's different from 5 years ago. It's different from 15 years ago when I started out, and it's certainly different from 25 years ago, you know, when I just started going to college and kind of getting into this music. So there's a lot to be excited about, but it's a business that can get you down if you decide to concentrate on those things. You know,
you've kind of, there's a lot in what you said.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, this is fantastic. This is what I like, is to get people going.
Sure.
Dig down beneath the pleasantries and the sort of typical light sound bites. I'd like to understand. I have a lifelong passion and interest in jazz too, so that's a question I ask. And you've what you just went through there, there's a handful of things I want to dig into further. And one of the things I'm trying to document and understand, I think you're one person who would have a very unique perspective on this. And I guess the question, I have a question that kind of breaks off into multiple questions, and it really gets down to, you know, you've explained how you got into jazz, that there was this early, you know, exposure to it in your family, and it probably a natural inclination to be musical, all of those things. But tying into a little bit about what you're talking about now, with you're working hard, but yes, there's still a market for jazz. Maybe I'll put it like this way. Well, there's a bunch of questions. First of all, what is jazz? Is it dead? And presumably you would agree it's not dead. And if it's not dead, what's important about it? Why is it important today?
It's definitely not dead. And, you know, I mean, I don't think we need to spend a lot of time talking about why it's not. I mean, just take a look. I mean, go to New York, there are people out there playing music all the time. I don't know if I would consider jazz more important than any other genre of music. I mean, it's certainly a more interactive, it's a interactive type of music, very creative, very, what's the word? It's very, it's very pure, it's very passionate, it's very real, and it has a huge, massively long history, both just musically, politically, you know, and I'm not really into that side of that. And those questions sometimes I find tough, like what is it or why is it important? It's just, it elicits something deep inside of me that other things don't. And some of those things are sort of more shallow than I would love to give you like some big philosophical answer, but I'm not a philosophical guy. I mean, yeah. I mean the history alone, and I mean, if you want to sort of simplify it for me, like just look back in the at the 50s, like for me, which is like kind of like the 50s is like my stuff, like Art Blakey and the Jazzmen, like Messengers, like look how hip those guys were. Look how cool they were. Like, it was just cool. Yeah. Clubs were packed and the musicians were cool, and they were cool. And it's just this music, they're just doing something that's like so unbelievably, so much feeling to it. There's so much passion, there's so much creativity, there's so much vulnerability, there's all of these things. And I think that more than anything, jazz kind of encompasses all of the things that we wish we kind of have. Like to get up and play your own song and to improvise on a stage in front of people is an extremely personal and vulnerable thing to do, and that alone just makes it something completely special. And that's not to take anything away from a rock musician or a classical musician, it's just different, and it communicates with people. And I think that when you look out into an audience, and this is not to say that the audience is not smart, but when you look out into the audience of 80 or 100 people, I would venture to guess that 75, even higher to 85% of those people have no idea about what we're doing. They're not going to sit there and say, oh man, I love what you played over that G minor 7 to C7 chord, and how you reharm that and how you did that tritone sub. They don't know that. They can't, you can't explain to them what a 32 bar song form is. They say, what's a bar? Yeah. It's a feeling.
Yeah.
You know, they walk away and go, you guys all look like you're having so much fun. You know, it's a feeling. It's the way it makes you feel. And I think music is, I don't particularly feel classical music the way, it doesn't mean I don't like it. It just doesn't, I don't feel it.
Right.
But, you know, if I listen to a beautiful pop ballad that has all these sus chords and nine chords, it's very pretty, like I really feel that, like I really get behind that. Or if I come in and hear a band playing like Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, like something super, you know, backbeaty and Blakey-ish, I'm like, you know, I love it. Yeah. You know, so it really is, it's a feeling for me. That's what jazz is, to simplify. You know, like I said, I can't go into some philosophical thing about it, 'cause I'm not that kind of guy. Yeah. You know, and politically, like, I understand that jazz is hugely political, but I don't, for me, no.
It's not, yeah. So, I don't know how much the average person would care to dig into the more detail on the musicians that you like, but I'm interested in. I think the audience I'm going after is probably partly musicians as well, and jazz musicians, so I'm really curious to kind of go back a little bit in your catalog, which I think you have a huge catalog, not only of your own albums that you've bought, but of course also your own record label.
Sure.
And I want to get to that. But again, going back to understand sort of what is Corey Weed's jazz, you know, library consist of, and what are maybe just some highlights of, you know, if you had a desert island,
sure,
take 10 albums.
Yeah, those questions are very easy. I mean, you know, I think I have a reputation of having a very narrow focus.
Okay.
And I don't feel a responsibility to like more music. I'm entitled, just as you are, to like what you like. Right. As a presenter of the music in this city for as long as I have been, I think I have a responsibility to try to be as open as possible. There are people who are much more open than me. But you know, but I went through it all. I mean, when I came at jazz from a more pop sensibility. I mean, you know, and I'm not afraid to say it. I mean, I sort of came through listening to some of the more smoother things like the Rippingtons and even Kenny G for that matter. But I very quickly got hip and, you know, Miles Davis, of course, and going through all that stuff. But then my whole thing became about, you know, I started doing radio. I started doing radio, and I started focusing a lot on talent deserving wider recognition. So I was watching a lot of the young people, guys like Chris Potter, Mark Turner, Kurt Rosenwinkel, guitarist, and getting into all modern stuff, and then started listening to Dave Holland's group, and I was all over that stuff. Then I left college and I got into this pop band, and then I realized, like, I hadn't even heard, like, Stevie Wonder to me was, I just called to say I love you. Like, I didn't realize, like, Stevie Wonder, man. And then that, and then James Brown, and then all that music, and Maceo Parker. Like, I just, my whole world was opened.
Right.
When I started to get back into the club stuff, and owning the club and playing my own music, it really started to become about a feeling for me and swing and bop, bebop, and hard bop. And I've stayed that way ever since. You know, so there's jokes about there that I like anything recorded from about 1954 to about 1962 that's recorded on Blue Note Records, which is totally true. You know, so, I mean, that's what I like. That's when I go home and throw on a record, that's usually what I'm doing. Or music that is recorded in that spirit. Mm-hmm. You know, as far as Desert Island Disc, I mean, for sure one of them for me is, and I always get the names mixed up, which is odd, just because there's two. I think it's Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers at the Jazz Corner of the World, which is Birdland, with Hank Mobley and Lee Morgan, like the Blakey band.
Yeah.
You know, and I've listened to that record. I've presented tributes to that specific record. Hank Mobley, Roll Call would be another one. This is going to sound odd to a lot of people, but there's a series of Chet Baker recordings that were made with George Coleman. I'm not sure the year. I'm going to guess early 60s with George Coleman, which is some of Chet's greatest playing, and it's just bebop. I mean, George Coleman is just amazing. You know, those are some that come, you know, Hank Mobley, Roll Call, which I said. Soul Station, another. I'm a big Hank Mobley guy. One that's recently, one that I would have to consider is Herbie Hancock's Taken Off with Dexter Gordon. They play Driftin' on that record, which is like right up my sort of alley. So, you know, I mean, those are four. And then some people that have sort of influenced me personally, George Robert, who was an alto player who lived in Vancouver for many years. He had a record called Looking Out that was very, very influential to me when I was growing up. And then there's some, you know, there's some local people that recorded records that, you know, were very important to my my whole aesthetic as a musician and as a lover of music. Hugh Fraser's Red and Blue with Ross Taggart and Campbell Riga. I mean, you know, these are things that were very special to me growing up. And but I think the first one I mentioned, like Hank Mobley, at the Jazz Corner of the World, Art Blakey at the Jazz Corner of the World, Hank and Lee, and Bobby Timmons and Jimmy Merritt, and of course Art, like that to me what jazz is supposed to be. That's the way it's supposed to, you're supposed to play it, that's the way it's supposed to sound, that's the way it's supposed to look in that big record cover, and that to me is really, that encompasses it all for me. I think there's a big, and I've gone on record many times saying this, I have no problem with innovation, but I think it's overrated. I think there's too many people out there trying to be new for the sake of being new. I personally don't, and I've never read Ornette Coleman's life story, but I don't think Ornette Coleman woke up one day and said, I'm gonna innovate and I'm gonna be new. It happened organically, and he organically did it and invented like a whole new way. I don't think he did it on purpose. That's just my belief. Mm-hmm. I could be totally wrong.
Right.
So I think today there's a lot of people trying to be new for the sake of being new. And that's fine. It doesn't mean I have to like it. But I just think there's way too much emphasis put on that. And I think a lot of people are criticized for not being innovative. And I think that's really sad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that critics, I think jazz festivals have been have had their wool pulled over their eyes. I think critics and magazines and radio people And record companies have had the wool pulled over their eyes, that because it's new and because it's innovative and because it's different, it's good. And that, I can say unequivocally that is not the case. I'm certainly not saying that you can't criticize me for wanting to play like Hank Mobley. You don't have to like that, that's fine. And if you think I'm boring or you think guys that play like that are boring, that's fine. But as far as I'm concerned, when I get up on the stage, I do some writing. I try to bring personal improvisations to the stage, and I try to bring my personal touch, and that for me is innovation enough. Mm-hmm. And I have no issues with people that want to be innovative. Go for it, do it. But I think it's just overrated, and I think it's given way too much credit. And I mean, I really truly believe that, and have no problem saying it on record ever. You know, but that's sort of how I feel about it.
I think I'm not far off on that one on yourself there. I was at Coltrane, not and still am, but was, you know, a major Coltrane freak. But I after 35 plus years of listening to Train, I haven't listened much past about 1965.
Sure, yeah. And I'm the same way. You know, I'm a fan of Train and who he was and what he did and the passion and virtuosity he brought to it, but I don't listen to anything past, you know, that stuff either. Yeah. You know, it's just not what I like to listen to.
It's different. Some people like it and other people don't. Yeah.
And I hang out with people, you know, as I'm getting older, I'm becoming a little more open-minded, you know, to stuff. But yeah, I mean, I like what I like and that's it. And I'm allowed to do that now.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I'm 42 and I do my thing and don't care what anybody else thinks, you know. Yeah. But as I said earlier, I do think I have a responsibility as a presenter of this music to at least try to convey a more open policy in terms of what I book and that kind of stuff. To a point, you know, the cellar was mine. I could do whatever I want. This club is not mine.
Right.
And I do not run Coastal Jazz and Blues. I simply work there. And so that puts a greater emphasis on maybe being a little bit more open-minded. And it doesn't mean I have to like it or be here when that stuff plays, but you have to appreciate it. I mean, I appreciate Ornette Coleman. I appreciate John Coltrane. I appreciate all of that stuff. It doesn't mean I like it.
You may not go home and listen to it when you get home or put it on in the car.
Yeah.
So, I do want to talk about this new collaboration between yourself and Coastal Jazz, but I'd like to maybe take a step back and talk a little bit about the cellar.
Sure.
There's so much to talk about with you. Hopefully we'll get a good chunk of the things that are exciting to me and to you, and I think to a lot of people out there. You're one of I can't think off the top of my head of anybody who's really doing what you're doing. You're playing music at a very high standard. I think people would generally agree with me that you're a tenor player of note. I mean, you really know how to play jazz, and you're a professional, and you know people go to see you play, and I've got some of your records too. But then you are an impresario, you're a record label owner, you're a producer, you're a business manager. You're doing all these things in jazz, and it's fantastic. So there's a lot to cover here. I'd like to maybe just go back and just give me some highlights and some things that stick with you about your time running the cellar.
Sure.
Like, you don't have to give me the full documentary on it, but what do you think about a lot when you think about your time running the cellar?
Well, I mean, first of all, I met my wife there, so, you know. I mean, you're right. I mean, I could go on at length. I think to try to summarize it accurately, I mean, I'll try to break it up. Yeah, it's hard.
There's a lot to cover.
A big question.
We could probably do a series.
Yeah,
but
so first of all, when I bought the club, really what I expected to happen was my music career to wind down, not that it was that wound up, but for it to wind down and I would become a club owner. And I would just be the guy that sat in that could kind of play, and they would invite me up because I could play and I was the owner, and then we'll let them play a tune and then let them go. What happened was the complete opposite. It took some time, but the complete opposite happened. And now looking back at it, it's obvious as to why. I mean, I was passionate. I could play. I was hearing the music all the time. I was a single guy with nothing but time in his hands. I'd wake up in the morning. I could go to the club and practice. Then I could give myself a gig whenever I want. You know, I mean, it's of course that's the way it happened. So just becoming the musician, I was able to, and the opportunities that I got and still get because of my, I mean, recording with Joey DeFrancesco and recording with and touring with Jim Rotundi and Steve, like all the stuff. I mean, you know, sitting in with Christian McBride. I mean, you know, it goes on and on. Those are opportunities that people just don't get. And I'm very lucky. I've worked hard, but I feel very grateful that I got those opportunities. So as a musician, I mean, what a great place to grow and to get opportunities to do the things that I did. I think the thing now, looking back, that I've been, now that I've been gone for 2 years, is just the people. I mean, I was surrounded by so many wonderful people who have been supportive of me in so many ways, some really big ways, like financially, and some just sort of mentally and emotionally supportive of me, and just met some really beautiful people. I mean, I really put my heart and soul out on the line, and because of that, I have people that I'm so, you know, again, it's that mentality of like, I'm not a young guy anymore. Like, I'm a real adult contributing to society.
Hard to think, isn't it?
And I'm a good guy. Like, I'm a good guy who has drawn these people, like, you know, to my, and it's really hard. I still have a really hard time. But when I go to bed at night, and I, like last night, I came down here and there were just people that I genuinely love that came to the club all the time. It's like, wow, like these people are in my life. They're so wonderful. And so that's really special to me. I mean, it should be said that in the early days of The Cellar, some of them came and went, but I had a group of five investors at one point who, quite frankly, gave me a lot of money and put a lot of money into The Cellar, knowing full well they'd likely never see a dime back. I don't know why they did it. I don't know how they did it. I don't know if they'd do it again. But those people, I'm forever indebted to those people on so many levels, and I'd never be able to repay them. I'm friends with, there have been some rough times, but I'm friends with all of them still. We still talk. Some of them still support me and support my efforts financially and otherwise. So, I mean, those people without question, but, you know, mostly the people, the life lessons. I mean, I almost felt like I was more ready for marriage because I owned a jazz club.
Little did I, married to a jazz club.
Little
first.
Did I know I wasn't quite ready, but, you know, I mean, yeah. It was challenging every issue I had, mm-hmm. you know, confrontation, like dealing with staff, dealing with customers, dealing with stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. It was just a real test. It was a lot of fun. I have no regrets, but I you couldn't give me back that scenario if you wrote a check with it for $1 million. I'm done. I did it. I loved it. It was great, but I'm done. I'm finished. You know, and then here we are sitting at this new thing. I'm like, interesting the way that worked out. You know, I am back, but I'm not back like I was at The Cellar, you know.
So you say you're even for any amount of money, you wouldn't run a jazz club again.
Not having the food and beverage side, not having the landlord I had, not, you know, not all that stuff. It's right. Just too much, you know.
But the Cellar experience was in itself fantastic.
Not
experience.
One single regret. I loved every minute of it, even the terrible parts of it. I mean, I learned a lot, and there's a part of the chaos a little bit that I miss, but it was just too much in the end. And now I don't have those worries. I have a whole different set of worries, and those are less than what I had at The Cellar. You know, the food and beverage side was hard, the staff, dealing with the staff, you know, it took away from the music. I did it for the music, the only reason I did it. Mm-hmm. I didn't do it so I could eat for free every night. I didn't care about that. I did it because of the music. And the music stopped becoming fun. Now it's like, okay, now you really have to step back. I didn't want to go. I didn't care who was playing. I didn't want to see the music. I didn't want to hear the music. I didn't want to hang out. I was done.
Right.
And that's when I turned around to my wife and said, now I'm finished.
Right.
And I was very lucky. I was able to get out without it costing a lot of money. I had somebody that helped me get out. It cost some money. But I was very, very, get out very graciously, and everybody got paid. Nobody got screwed. It was a wonderful time of I was very lucky to get all the emails that I got, and felt very good about the contribution I had made, and that moved me on to this crazy next phase of 2 years of not knowing, like, what am I doing? Like, you're a musician now. Like, you don't have that check anymore right. that comes in every 2 weeks. I fell and broke my elbow the night after we closed. So my foray into the, hey, I'm a full-time musician, was started by, you have to lose $1,600 worth of work because you can't play.
Wow.
So that was crazy. I definitely got to spend lots of time with my family. Because of all the goodwill I had built up with the club, I got a lot of gig calls, and so I was doing it. I started the Cellar Jazz Society and started presenting concerts. So I closed in March, end of February, started presenting concerts, was going to start this nonprofit and hopefully get charitable status and kind of, you know.
Then that was what? When was that?
Well, that would have been right after the club closed.
2013?
14. So, yeah. Right. And then what ended up happening, a lot of things happened. I got a job with the Vancouver Musicians Association. Then the executive director position came available at Coastal Jazz, which I was underqualified for in many respects, but I got shortlisted for that position. And now looking back at it, I don't think I was ever going to get the job, and I was thankful I didn't get the job. But if I had to guess, the board of Coastal Jazz was keeping me close and, you know, kind of feeling me out for where I could possibly fit into the organization. I didn't get the job, and I was really disappointed I didn't get the job. But the first thing that happened when the person got the job was I was introduced to him and we became instant friends, because I think that they, you know, the board and sort of Coastal said, like, I think we need to, like, it's Corey should be here, and we don't know how he's going to be here and what he's going to do. So the first phase was they took over the Cellar Jazz Society. So I was, and that happened, I'm kind of mixed up, like last January. So that would have been January 2014. My series was run under the umbrella of Coastal Jazz, and I was paid a salary. The second part of my job was education and outreach coordination, which is still a developing theme. And then the third part was, how are we gonna get Corey here full time? Because I was pushing full time. I didn't have my union gig, so I was still like looking for something. And I did a New Year's gig here last year. That was a separate thing from Coastal. And the owner of Frankie's wanted to meet with me. And I thought it was going to kind of be like, we want to have music here, but, you know, we don't have any money. And I'm like, you know, that's a story I always get. Yeah, we really want to have live music. Oh, we have to pay you? Forget it. You know, so I kept kind of saying, leave me alone. Yeah, I can't do it. He's like, look, come down. Let me buy you lunch. I was like, oh, free lunch. Great. So I came down and met Raphael, who's the owner, and he said, here's what I want to do. I've got this space here, you know, I'll spare you all the boring details. And so I thought about it for a long time. I thought about it. I went back and forth, another meeting, proposals back and forth. And what ended up happening is he presented to me three options. Because I said, look, I don't want to take any risk. I can't take any risk. Like, you got to, you know. And the proposal I like the most that he presented was the one with the most risk, because that's how I am. I love the risk because I love the reward.
Right.
So I talked with my wife and said, no, I can't do it. But I said, I know what we need to do. I need to take this to Coastal. Coastal needs to take it over, and they need to hire me to run it. And that's essentially exactly what's happened. It allowed me to get into the office full time. And it's great, because what I have that I didn't have at the Cellar, I've got, and this can be equally as frustrating as it can be exciting, because I was the trigger man at the Cellar all the time. It was my club, do whatever I want, whenever I want, whoever I want. Now I deal with a team, but it's great. I got a financial team, I got a marketing team, I got a programming team, I got a team, a development team, an information team. I mean, it's really great. So Coastal really has their marketing together, especially on the social side. It's phenomenal. And it's great. So I don't have to worry about the food and liquor. I don't have to worry about the staff. I just have to worry about what I'm really good at. And what I'm really good at is assembling musicians, booking musicians, knowing what draws, knowing what doesn't draw, knowing what's going to work, coming up with special projects, all that kind of stuff. So it really is a win-win. I wasn't thrilled about getting back into the club business, but sometimes you have to honor what you're really good at. And the reality is that there wasn't a lineup of people offering me jobs. I was doing really well as a musician, but I was having to work really hard at doing well.
Right.
And it's not like I was doing well, like, hey, I'm making 100 grand a year, so it's all worth it.
Yeah.
You know, I was making a very fair income, but you know, the amount of work I had to put into that. And as soon as I took a break, it's like, oh, if you take a break for 2 weeks, that means that 3 months down the road, you have nothing.
That's right.
And I'm like,
you say no to this call, to this call.
Yeah, I can't do this.
The calendar starts.
I just don't want to do this, you know?
Yeah.
So now I'm negotiating between having a full-time gig and not having the time to spend on my instrument. But I mean, that's what everybody goes through.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to figure that all out. But like, all in all, it's been an extremely positive experience. Coastal's great to work with. The programming team is fantastic. You know, I like the man. My favorite part of the, I mean, if Coastal hears this, they'll laugh because I'm always joking about it. There's a lot of meetings. We got to meet. I actually really enjoy the meetings. The management meetings are really fun and educational for me, and the programming meetings and just figuring out how they work. And it's a very natural fit for me, and they've given me some autonomy to do what I want to do, which is great, which is very important for me. I'm still allowed to play. I'm still allowed to present. I'm still allowed to do whatever I want. So it's been really, it's been a lot of fun, you know, I think this place, Frankie's, has the potential to be really a special place and a new home for jazz and blues here without the stress of everything. It took a little bit of capital investment to get the stage happening, but that's really all.
Yeah.
Now it's about what comes in the door versus what goes out. I mean, that's the backbone of any business, but what I mean is that, you know, I had a funny call. Let me said, oh, how's the club doing this weekend? Oh, I'm like, we got 40 resos this weekend. They're like, and you're happy about that? I'm like, yeah. I said, well, why are you happy? And I said, well, I said, my costs are $600. The cover is 15. So guess what? The costs are covered. At the cellar, I needed 40 people to pay the band, and then I needed another 40 people to pay for the broken plates, for the staff, for the lights, for the broken refrigerator, for the floods that were happening.
Sure.
I mean, all the stuff. I don't have that anymore.
Right.
Obviously, we want 80 people because we want this to profit so we can increase programming and we can do more and we can improve the sound and make it. But all I got to worry about is we're paying out $2,000 this weekend. We got to make sure that $2,000 comes in. And that's a great feeling.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really, really good feeling.
You've kind of have a win-win situation here. You found a very good recipe for bringing everybody, bringing their core competencies or their sunk costs, their assets.
Yeah.
And there's an asset here. You've got Coastal Jazz with their folks, and you've got your your skill as an impresario and a lover of jazz. So you have all those things. So here's the opportunity to do a little, you know, shameless plugging and advertising. Tell us what's coming down the pipe here. What is exciting in the next little while?
So first of all, our proximity to the stadiums actually at first was looked upon as a bit of a negative, but actually we've really turned that into a positive. So when there are game nights, football, soccer, hockey, you'll find blues at Frankie's, which is great because it allows us to appeal and access a wider community of musicians, something that Coastal Jazz hasn't done.
Right.
And quite frankly, something I haven't done,
right,
you know, my time at the Cellar. So we had the Bradley McGillivray Blues Band here. We had Steve Kozak here. We're hoping to have Brick House here, like to get some really fun. And it's nice for the people too to come down. So you don't have to be quiet. Come down and party.
Exactly.
Drink beer, party. Yeah. The game will let out. Second set's free.
Yeah.
You come down you know, it's cool. And then on the jazz nights, it's be quiet. Keep your voices down, listen to the music.
Okay.
And then, so we've got a bunch of local stuff that's upcoming. And there has been some confusion around the branding. You go to coastaljazz.ca, you don't go to Frankie's Italian Kitchen. It's a Coastal Jazz thing.
Right.
All of our stuff lives there. Starting in January, we're doing a lot of the same special events here that we did at the Cellar. So for example, I think it's the 8th and 9th of January, we have something called the Power Quintet coming from New York. It's a Jeremy Pelt, Steve Nelson on vibes, Peter Washington on bass, Bill Stewart on drums, and Danny Grissett on piano. So that's two nights. Then the following
I'll take
weekend,
a couple of tickets right now.
Yeah, so the following week we have Steve Davis sextet plays the music of J.J. Johnson. Steve Davis on
Steve
trombone
Davis?
From New York.
Oh, okay, not the bass
trombone.
Player.
Trombone. Okay. Eric Alexander on tenor saxophone, a big mentor of mine, and Josh Bruno, trumpet player from New York. So that's happening for three nights.
Wow.
Gary Bartz is booked in February.
Wow.
Great alto player, of course, played with Miles Davis,
yeah,
and has gone
yeah.
on to a great career. Ralph Alessi and his group is coming. He's a wonderful trumpet player. So, like, it's really, in the new year, we really kick it up a notch, and it really becomes a lot more like what we were doing at the Cellar. Champion Fulton, wonderful singer, is going to be here for two nights. We're doing about a 10-day celebration of women in jazz and women band leaders, and so we've got a bunch of nights booked with all, not all female bands, but feature females. So we're excited about that. So, and it's a venue we can do whatever we want with, like we don't have to rent stuff and you know, it's very cool. So, I mean, there's so much great stuff upcoming, and we've got a really great social media presence, so that's been very cool. We've got a hashtag that's Frankie's Jazz, so, you know, we encourage people to take pictures and video and post them and you know, get the word out that way. So it's really cool. There's tons of great stuff upcoming, and you know, it's going to be four nights a week, and then we're going to be looking at, right now we go Thursday through Sunday, and then we're looking at extended programming, like, because we're downtown. So 10:30 is when we're ending on Friday, Saturday. That's early.
Yeah.
At the Cellar, it wasn't early. At the Cellar,
yeah, exactly.
It was late.
Yeah.
Down here, it's different. So how can we get an 11-to-1 crowd
jazz in? Jam or something like
Thursday
that.
Thursday and Friday, can we do a happy hour, kind of early evening after work crowd? Like, how can we work that stuff kind of into it? So the opportunities are really endless, and it would be really easy to, like, just jump into everything right away and go, but you got to kind of do it slowly. And if the first 4 weeks are any indication, we're going to be just fine. And there's going to be some surplus there to have some fun with and increase the programming. So it's great. It's really good. So.
Excellent. So the label, you've got almost 100.
Yeah, it's 100,
I mean,
110
if,
now, I think.
As if the, you know, being a successful jazz musician, playing with the guys you mentioned, running the best jazz bar in town for over, you know, a decade and a half.
Yeah.
You know, being involved with Coastal Jazz and the role, just, I mean, you know, I'm jealous of you on like 12 or 15 different things. And now here, I mean, perhaps the thing that I'm like looking at going, that bastard, how the hell does he do it?
Yeah.
You've got a jazz label and you've recorded like Peter Bernstein, you're hanging with, you know, Harold Mayburn, you're, you know, I mean, oh man, that guy's just like, you know, you're kind of like my hero.
How do you do it?
So, you know, you've, what's going on with the jazz label, you know?
Well,
how's that going?
Yeah, I mean, let me, you know, because that's the question I get the most, like, how do you do it all? And I have to say, like, yeah, it's a lot, but everything I do, it's like a big circle. So everything, like, happens, it's not, it happens because of something else. So anybody in my position who started out like me or, you know, like any musician could start a label and any musician could start a club. So just anything kind of, it just happens because of something else. So like one gig turns into two gigs turns into five. Oh, then you have a Canada Council grant applicant. Oh, that turns into a whole tour. Oh, why don't we record at the end of the tour? Oh, I'll put, you know, so it, you know,
they feed off each other.
They feed off each other. I'm not comfortable saying good things about myself, but one thing I do is I put my money where my mouth is, or might be better stated, I put other people's money where my mouth is. But I'm not, you know, I do it. I like taking risks and I do it. And a lot of people are not comfortable. Now I have put myself in some precarious situations financially in the past and I've done okay. And I've lost some too. Yeah, I've won and lost. The label is an interesting one because I keep saying I'm trying to wind it down because for the obvious reasons that, you know, the CD's dead, the music industry's dying and, but as long as we're doing a sort of niche market stuff, you know, and working in small venues, like the CD still has a lot of validity. Like if you look around at my audience, the average age is above 50. These are not people that are downloading iTunes, people buying CDs. And, you know, I have a good distribution deal in Japan. So like I'm selling enough to make it. I'm not making any money, but I'm selling enough to keep making more releases. Yeah. So I keep saying it's going to end, but then I get presented with another opportunity. It's like, oh, you know, so at some point it's going to end or going to change. And I'm going to be left holding the bag at some point. I need to figure out and decide how much of the bag I want to be holding.
Right.
So as long as I'm working with artists that are touring and who are out there, like my CDs sell really well because I'm out there. I'm playing a lot. So I sell 10 here and 10 there and 20 here. And, you know, other artists that I deal with, you know, are out there doing it. And as long as you're out there doing it, then we're good, mm-hmm. you know, because you're going to sell CDs. So, you know, like I said, I have good distribution. I get great press. And that just kind of continues. And, you know, when you have a label of 110 releases, like that generates, you know, not a lot of revenue, but it generates revenue. So it's, I would say it's a revenue generator. I wouldn't say it's a money maker.
Right.
But I've certainly had to get more selective as to what I release and what I don't release. And then we license some stuff too. So I act as a, not license, that's not the right terminology, but like I act as a portal for other artists that come to me and say, hey, can Seller Live put this out? Well, yeah, you can, but you, like you have to pay for everything. And that's, I don't feel bad about that model. Mm-hmm. That's a model because people want label representation.
Sure.
Because now when you send a Seller Live record to a radio station, it now goes to the top of the pile instead of the bottom with sure. all the other CDs. Oh, Seller Live, great. That's going to be good. You know, so I'll just sort of continue that and monitor it as much as I can and try to make smart choices and, you know, try to make some smart choices and hope in the end that I'm not holding the bag full of, you know, holding the bag, you
sure,
know, is
sure.
really what it's about. And you know, I look around at what other labels are doing, and you know, it's not like Seller Live's the only label. I mean, there's a market for it. Like I said, I think you just have to be selective. And it's, you know, places have disappeared. Like there's no record stores anymore, but there's internet. So you're still selling stuff on internet. Like my Condition Blue record has sold so well, and I keep getting orders from Amazon. It's insane. Like my distributor keeps saying, yeah, I need 100 more, and I need 50 more. I'm like, what? You know, and you go on, you see Amazon is selling a lot, and.
Wow.
Live performance and you know all of that kind of stuff. Our stuff does well on radio, so that helps. And you know, and I think you just I look at it. Not a lot of artists have this are able to have this mentality, but it's just really about is what's going out more than what's coming in. If it is, then you have a problem.
Yeah.
So I don't take my record and go okay. This costs $6,000 to make, therefore, after I give all the way promo, I have 500 records, therefore I have to sell 500 at $15 to make break even. I don't think like that, because if you do that, you'll go, what? I wouldn't, if I did that, I wouldn't put out any records.
Right, right.
But what has this record brought you? What did the last record bring you? Mm. And the example I use is my record with Joey DeFrancesco. I mean, based on what I had to pay to make that record, never gonna make the record. I'm never gonna make the money back on selling of the records, but that gig got me a really good gig with him in Pittsburgh that paid really well, and I sold a ton of my CD that I recorded after that one and that one. So it's about, you know, again, it's about are you bringing in more than you're paying out? And if you are, you're doing okay. If you're not, then you have to relook at the model. And you know, I remember I did a clinic with somebody, you know, it was a long time ago. I did these business of music clinics, and the premise behind it was like, look, I don't know the right way, I just know my way.
Right.
And I'm happy to share whatever, like ask me, I have experience in every facet of the industry, so ask me whatever you want, let's have a discussion about it. And some kid said, you know, oh, you know, you had it easy, you know, you got a jazz club and you got it easy. And I understood what he was getting at, but I was like, really? I said, I have it easy? Okay. I started a club and I had one investor. But I said, you think it's easy when somebody's coming to you saying, I'll invest in your club, and then you have to spend the next 4 years, like every time you need more money, you got to make that call and say, like, I can't make payroll or I can't do that. Like, it's not easy. And, you know, now I'm at a point where I've created all of these things. So my chance at bringing in more than I'm paying out is greater than some guy that's just starting out We didn't have that. Right. But like, that's where I started. So, you know, you need to sort of, and I get people asking me for their advice all the time. And it's just like, you know, it's an old cliche, but follow what you believe in, follow your dream, be honest, be as transparent as you can, and hopefully good things will happen. I haven't done everything right, and I'll continue to make mistakes. But, you know, I think in the end, I've won more battles than I've lost, both personally and financially. And so therefore, you know, I'm ahead of the game. I'm not far ahead of the game, but I'm ahead of the game, and I'm doing what I love. So, you know, after that, it doesn't matter.
One last question. Mm. I don't know what the critical reception of your film, I think it was your film debut in Bruno's Blues, but do you have any plans to return to Hollywood?
No, I don't have any return plans to, oh God, that was so funny. Let me see, I'm trying to think of, I was not in Smoking Assassins, I was just a consultant, so no, I don't have, movie work is not my...
You're not going back to the screen anytime.
No, I mean, working with Bruno was great because I didn't even know I was doing it. You know, a camera crew showed up and said, we need to film you. I was like, what? You know,
so that wasn't staged, that interaction?
No, it was not staged. Nothing with Bruno is ever staged. So, you know, it was, yeah, it was funny.
So that was real then? You were guys bickering, you're telling him that... You thought he was really trying to get money to start a magazine, or?
No, okay, so that part of it, I mean, was a little bit written, but I didn't have any warning that they were coming with a film crew that day. It was like, what? And the funniest part, I don't know if you picked it up, but the funniest part is I was practicing soprano, and I have a No Kenny G shirt on. If you go back and watch it, look at my shirt. And again, that was total fluke, like that, you know. Yeah, Bruno, classic. Unsung hero, though, a real Vancouver treasure. Incredible musician, you know.
Yeah. Thank you.
Cool.
I appreciate
no problem.
The time. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I mean, anytime. You know, I love to talk about this stuff, and it's funny to sit here and do these interviews. Like, wow, I really do have a lot of experience.
Oh,
you know,
no question.
So I like talking about it. I'm passionate about it, and I'm, you know, so anytime.